The next speaker is John Simon. John's runs the research operations at the RBA. He actually very kindly was discussing last year. We're very glad to have him speak this year. I think you've been in the States just before then, hasn't you? MIT?
IMF.
IMF. Well,
for the yes, TLA.
And so over to you, John, if you don't mind. And again, thanks to the RBA for being a sponsor of this and for the support they give us.
So thank you for having me. I suppose whenever anybody with RBA or any other TLA after their name speaks, kind of one needs to make a disclaimer. So at this point, I'd like to say these are my views. What I'm saying has no implications for monetary policy today, tomorrow in Australia. Really what I'm focusing on is an issue that's of global concern. It's not particularly focused on Australia. It's very much thinking about kind of this low interest rate environment that we now find ourselves in. And if anything, the concerns that I talk about and the way I think about it is very much informed by that global environment and discussion rather than being focused on Australia. So there are no hidden messages here about monetary policy. So to start, in recent years, there's been an increasing concern that periods of low interest rates, such as those that we're experiencing now, pose a problem for economic and financial stability. People fear that low interest rates encourage excessive risk-taking. The immediate cause of the concern appears to have been the global financial crisis. The standard narrative is you had low interest rates in the 2000s, that caused a build-up of risk, and ultimately that caused the financial crisis. And then people look at current low interest rates and worry that history might be repeating. And these concerns have been showing up in various places. Indeed, some of them were already appearing before the crisis. So, for example, you have Rajan in 2006 suggesting that, say, investment managers in pursuing higher returns have incentives to take risks that are hidden from investors. This is the so-called search for yield. In a slightly different area, you've got John Taylor talking about the fact that low interest rates between 2003 and 2005, too low interest rates brought about a search for yield, contributed to the housing bubble in the US, and thus was a key factor in the financial crisis. More recently, you've got the concerns associated with secular stagnation. In this environment, there's a chronic shortfall of demand. Even zero nominal interest rates may not be sufficient to restore equilibrium. And as Larry Summers has said, this is an environment that might be conducive to bubbly asset prices. And, you know, the lower real interest rates can encourage the formation of financial bubbles, and maybe we're destined to be an environment with low interest rates punctuated by brief periods of bubbles. So what does one to make of these concerns? Are low interest rate environments inherently unstable, promoting financial and macroeconomic instability wherever they go? No, I don't think so. And before getting to that conclusion, I think it's probably worthwhile going over some of the arguments that I've just kind of spelled out in brief there to clarify why we might be concerned, because I think there is substance to these concerns before turning to the point about why I'm more sceptical. So let me kind of flesh out the arguments. So the first one we have is from Rajan here, looking very imposing. And search for yield shouldn't be a bad thing. Indeed, this is how the system should work. Investor search for yield is how funds are allocated to their most productive use. But when you talk about search for yield, people have in mind a very different state of affairs. As set out by Rajan, it's the argument that nominal benchmarks are embedded in financial markets. For example, life insurance companies might have written contracts that guarantee minimum nominal returns. Investment managers might have mandates with nominal targets. So when inflation or real interest rates fall, it gets harder to reach the nominal target, and instead of choosing a more sensible benchmark, they take on more risk. An alternative is that markets are beset by serious principal agent problems. Now, these aren't necessarily particular to low interest rate environments, but if you combine that with kind of these nominal rigidities, what you find is that managers have an incentive to take on excessive risk, particularly tail risk. So that's the idea that if you can't observe it, if it only happens once every 10 or 20 years, managers will be inclined to take on the small carry that they gain, and that excessive tail risk that only shows up, well past they get their next bonus, is all right. So in a similar vein, we've got Jeremy Stein here, who's introduced the idea of yield-oriented investors, possibly created by quirks in accounting rules. So this isn't irrationality, this is just investors responding to the way their accounting rules are, and so that they care only about current bond yields and not the mark-to-market price or the capital gain or loss they might make on it, because all they recognise in their income statements is what they earned on the coupon this period. But the evidence here is actually quite mild and anecdotal. Stein presents some evidence that there might be a yield-oriented investors in the market, but this is all pretty circumstantial stuff. There's better evidence in such an august journal as Econometrica, you know it's pretty good, that there is increased risk-taking by banks in low-interest rate environments. So we've got Jimenez and his co-authors. What do 23 million bank loans say about the effects of monetary policy on credit risk-taking? It's a really neat paper. And what they find is that there is this bank risk-taking channel of effect for monetary policy. In Canada, there's a similar effect being found for mutual funds by Gungor and Sierra, and they find that expansionary monetary policy induces risk-taking behaviour by mutual funds. So moving on, we've got John Taylor's argument, and at least insofar as it relates to the causes of the financial crisis, it's relatively straightforward. Interest rates lower than is consistent with historical patterns, that is, below the Taylor rule, stimulated the US economy excessively, and that simultaneously contributed to both a search for yield and the housing bubble. So interest rates were set inappropriately low, combined that with lax regulatory policy, and this contributed to a strong but fragile US economy, most notably evidenced in the housing bubble. And in this respect, he's actually in agreement with a lot of commentators, including Ben Bernanke here, although there is an important difference in emphasis. Bernanke emphasises the lax regulatory policy and says that, you know, there's only a secondary or maybe an indirect role for interest rates here. You know, he says maybe to the extent that low interest rates contributed to stability in the Great Moderation, this might have lulled investors into a sense of security about the amount of risk out there, and in that environment maybe they took on too much. A similar argument's been made for other countries like Spain and Ireland, where inappropriately low interest rates, set as they were by the ECB for the whole of the Eurozone, are blamed for their housing bubbles and subsequent financial distress. Now we turn to secular stagnation. Larry Summers, once again looking quite imposing, I think. The basic argument is that there's an excess of global savings relative to the available productive investments. This excess of savings drives down the interest rate, and because of a combination of structurally lower equilibrium interest rates and the zero lower bound, it's not possible for the interest rate to fall far enough to equalise supply and demand. And as a result, you've got excess funds looking for a home. And this is what Larry has argued leads to a bubbly economy. In a world where you've got few productive investment opportunities associated with the depressed economic conditions, asset purchases can look particularly attractive. And this can contribute to a self-reinforcing cycle as the resulting asset price rises, as everybody buys these attractive assets given the lack of alternatives, becomes justification for further investment. You can get rational bubbles, maybe. Now, at least in distinction from the other arguments, this secular stagnation argument is not actually an argument against lowering interest rates. It's actually an argument for doing more and doing it more aggressively, because the fundamental problem is the gap between supply and demand, and raising rates would only widen that gap. Now, this argument that interest rates might be structurally lower is consistent with kind of more empirical work that has looked at what's been happening to real-world interest rates. And they've been on a downward trend for 25 years. And it doesn't look like, say, the work of the IMF, that it's going to be reversed anytime soon. You've got some work by Caballero and Fari, who expand on the ideas and suggest that you might get stuck in a safety trap. This is where there's a kind of chronic, as opposed to acute, shortage of safe assets. And in this environment, financial bubbles may crowd out other risky but productive investment. And so all you end up with is that environment that people spoke about, which is you've got low interest rates, punctuated by periods of financial bubbles, but investment in these bubbles doesn't actually solve the underlying problem. So I think these are all grounds for concern, but I've only really given you one side of the story. So now I'm going to turn to the arguments about why I'm more sceptical, why I think this evidence, while suggestive, is just suggestive. So the fact that lower interest rates have been found to induce greater risk-taking is not of itself a reason to avoid lowering interest rates. Indeed, that's the point sometimes. One of the ways that lower interest rates stimulate economic activity is to encourage the granting of loans to entrepreneurs who couldn't otherwise get those loans. And none of the papers that I referred to or I've read can really distinguish between appropriate and desired risk-taking and inappropriate and undesired risk-taking. So that means that, while it's suggestive, we don't yet know that this is excessive or inappropriate. There might be a search for yield, but it might be exactly how the system works. We're just much more attuned to it. Another concern with the results from Jimenez is that interest rates really weren't being set appropriately for the Spanish economic conditions. Policy was being set in Frankfurt for the Eurozone. Great for econometric identification, less so when thinking about conditions like now, when low interest rates are being set appropriately for the conditions. So in that respect, I think the experience of the mid-2000s, when economic conditions were buoyant and interest rates were generally too low, at least with the benefit of hindsight, is not necessarily the best guide to thinking about what the conditions of today might lead to. Another aspect of the debate is that when you have lower real interest rates, asset prices can be higher for fundamental reasons. If you discount the future less, then the asset prices will be higher. So the observation that we have higher asset prices is not immediately an indication, you know, could be one way or another, but of itself it doesn't prove anything about there being bubbles or not. So, you know, we've got grounds to be concerned, but I also think that there might be an excess sensitivity to anything that looks remotely like the financial crisis. And ultimately, this is an empirical question. There might be too much risk-taking, but we don't know. So how would we go about working out whether low interest rates are consistently or predictably associated with excessive risk-taking? The argument for the moment seems to be, well, there were low interest rates in the GFC, but there's a much broader body of research which says, you know, looks at the GFC and looks at what causes financial crises. So it's to that that I want to turn now. So there are many studies out there, many of them are similar, but I found a recent ECB one by Jan Bakkerby quite interesting. They used some nice econometric techniques to work out which are the best early warning indicators across a large set of financial crises in developed economies. You're not really meant to read this, so I'll kind of, you know, you're just meant to get the general impression here. And what they find is that the most robust early warning indicator showing up in all of their models is domestic private credit. At long horizons, increasing household debt and decreasing corporate interest rate spreads also show up as indicators. At shorter horizons, money market rates make an appearance. All of which they interpret as showing that banking crises happen during expansion phases. You know, we're not in an expansion phase really at the moment. Low interest rates, however, way down there, really don't show up as a reliable indicator. And this lack of significance is fairly consistent across all these studies. So why are people concerned? An alternative concern that I mentioned relates to asset prices. People think that low interest rates are associated with greater asset price volatility, and maybe that's what causes the financial volatility. But looking at the breadth of history suggests there's no particular link between interest rates and financial or asset price instability. So current low interest rates have led to talk about a bond bubble, but this isn't the first time interest rates have been this low, and maybe we can learn something from history. So this is US 10-year bond yields from 1950 And what I've got at the bottom is the rolling 2-year standard deviation of the price. And what you can see is that there's no real correlation between the level of the yields and the price volatility. Low bond yields are not obviously inherently volatile. Back in the 50s and 60s, we had similarly low yields and price volatility was about the same as today. In the 70s, you had much higher yields and price volatility was about the same as today. Heck, if anything, it's higher then. So that would suggest, actually, if anything, it's the opposite of the way the argument seems to be made. What about historical bubbles? Are they generally associated with low interest rates? Now, I wrote a paper a few years ago that looked at Australian examples, and while credit and leverage were present in all of the Australian examples I looked at, low interest rates weren't. For example, the 1987 stock market bubble and subsequent commercial property bubble, that was in an environment of high interest rates. Rates were above 10% for pretty much all of the 1980s, frequently approaching 20%. And there are many periods when low interest rates have not been associated with excessive risk-taking. Indeed, low interest rates have been a much more common feature of the financial system than high interest rates, which are really a product of the 1970s and their aftermath. And so it's to this longer-term perspective that I want to turn next. So here we have 400 years of interest rates. And we see that throughout most of that period, interest rates have been pretty low. Looking at these UK monetary policy interest rates, we see that from around 1700, they spent a long time at 5%, which is the sort of level that was also happening just before the GFC. It's not obvious to me that 5% there is a particular problem, but that's what the levels were prior to the GFC in the UK. In the 50 years prior to World War I, they ranged between 2 and 6%, and they were stuck at 2% for much of that time. During the Great Depression and World War II, they were similarly low, stuck at 2% until the 1950s. And yet, despite interest rate settings similar to today, the aftermath of the Great Depression did not lead to another financial crisis. Rates were low, but appropriately so. Moving on to more recent times, now we've got some Australian data, you can see that, as with most countries, nominal interest rates were low and stable through the 40s, 50s and 60s. They only really took off in 1973. And yet, just like the post-depression 30s, the 50s and 60s are not particularly associated with excessive risk-taking. Now, a large part of the explanation here is the policy of financial repression. Quantity and other controls were used to direct savings towards government bonds at artificially low rates. High-risk commercial ventures couldn't get access to credit because of controls on the quantity of credit rather than the level of the interest rates. So banks rationed credit and only gave it to the highest quality borrowers. So while underlying growth was strong, de facto prudential standards were actually very tight. Now, even after deregulation, however, you had high nominal lending rates. This, in a high inflation environment, also tended to act as a de facto prudential control. People had to demonstrate an ability to repay the loan, and with high nominal interest rates, the repayment constraint was a binding one. Loan servicing became much easier after the first few years because of high wage inflation. So really, if banks just ensured you could pay the loan for the first couple of years, inflation took care of the rest. Now, you can also see this is kind of the 1987 level of interest rates when we had the stock market and commercial property bubble. Now, it's pretty high, historically speaking, in Australia. So what I want to emphasise from this short tour of history is that the pre-crisis period was actually pretty abnormal. It's only when you really had this combination of low nominal interest rates, solid growth, a deregulated banking system, that the finger of blame started turning towards interest rates. But even then, there were differences. Most countries had low interest rates, but prudential standards varied. Some countries managed the environment fairly well, but this was clearly not universal. So I think one can conclude that even in a buoyant low interest rate environment, appropriately calibrated prudential policy can help to restrain risk-taking by financial institutions. So, what is one to make of it? I think my discussion should make clear that I don't think low interest rates on their own are inherently risky or destabilising. Rather, it's inappropriately low interest rates. that is low interest rates during times of strong economic growth combined with inadequate prudential supervision that is ultimately destabilising. Now, even if one accepts that low interest rates might be part of the problem, they aren't actually the indicator you should be looking at. As reflected in the results of the early warning literature and the fact that excessive leverage is commonly associated with bubbles, some sort of credit measure is a better one to look at. Credit tends to be a reflection of the relative speed of growth, the tightness of prudential policy, and the tightness of monetary policy, while interest rates alone are a very poor indicator. But this isn't to say that credit is the only thing you should look at, it's just that it's better than interest rates. So, to sum up, in 2007 we had a combination of factors that each contributed to the financial crisis. The economy, the world economy, was growing strongly, but contained inflation led many central banks to set low interest rates that maybe with the benefit of hindsight were too low. In some economies, prudential regulation was clearly inadequate to constrain the deregulated banking sector. Together, this gave us a highly leveraged financial sector, and as you say, the rest is history. Now, this leads to kind of a corollary or another observation, and this is applicable to many post-crisis advanced economies today rather than being focused on Australia. Other than low interest rates, none of these conditions seem to be relevant now. Growth is weak, credit growth is especially low, there are many people paying down debt and not many investing. We could probably do with more entrepreneurial risk-taking, not speculative and leveraged speculation, but entrepreneurial risk-taking, real activity. And also we notice that prudential regulators, chastened by the experience of the financial crisis, are generally raising standards. Here in Australia, a few months ago, we heard that APRA was raising the capital charges on some mortgage lending, and the major banks have raised their interest rates on investment loans. So, you know, it never pays to be complacent, but there are a few early warning indicators at the moment. And so, the low interest rates, I think, really aren't something that one should be looking at. They're entirely appropriate given the weak economic growth. So I think that the concerns expressed by people like John Taylor and those who worry about a search for yield or the low interest rates are probably overdone. But, you know, there will undoubtedly be problems in the future. But I suspect, as has happened so many times in history, they'll come from an unexpected direction. So I think rather than fighting the last battle again, it's important to look ahead and try and discover the seeds of the next recession. I saw this quote as I was preparing this presentation in the FT. It seems to kind of capture it. You know, I think too much focus on the last battle and not enough focus on the future can lead to problems. Now, in this respect, after I've spent half an hour telling everyone where not to look, I think most of the people in this room might be in a much better position to suggest where we should be looking instead. So, thank you, and happy to take some questions.
I'm not sure if this is a scenario for you, but one of the biggest owners of US Treasuries is the Chinese government for its foreign reserves, and I was reading yesterday about this very big rundown of the level of Chinese reserves in the last quarter. So is that something that the bank's sort of focused on or worried about, what that means and what's driving that?
It's not something that I've been focusing on, so best not to comment.
Yes, sir.
Leverage.
Yep.
That does the damage. I agree. The question is there anywhere in the world there is leverage at the moment, and we just rely on it as the prices stay higher? First thing you look at is the house on the debt.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And the other one is the government. It's quite high in many places around the world. And then you look at each other, and you can. Do you have anywhere, can you identify anywhere where you're worried about leverage?
I mean, so not leverage per se, but this is the dynamic of the secular stagnation argument, which is when you look at, for example, Europe, you see that they've got low interest rates and high government debt, and it really feels like you know, what is the solution? It's very hard to think of what the solution is there. They don't have leverage. I think kind of the leverage was prior to the crisis, or if you were to be concerned, you would be concerned about leverage in advance, in emerging economies who haven't, you know, who escaped most of the effects of the financial crisis, which was mostly advanced economies. So I think, you know, you've got the secular stagnation argument, which gives you reason to be concerned about what might be going on in, say, Europe. And then to the extent that there are leverage concerns, they're more in the countries that escaped the worst effects of the financial crisis.
Yes. Would you expect, whether it be a business or a fund manager, would you expect them to be reducing their return assumptions, their cost of capital assumptions as a function of this much lower interest rate environment? Because that doesn't seem to be the case.
That would certainly seem to be, you know, the evidence that shows that real interest rates have been declining for 25 years would suggest that. Now, they need to make an allowance for risk. But I do think that the expectations that have been built up in high inflation periods, and to the extent that people have kind of got these nominal benchmarks in there, people should be kind of reevaluating that and thinking about it. I mean, I think investment managers should be doing this all the time. Obviously, you don't change it all the time, but hanging on to benchmarks that were set 10 or 20 years ago is also inappropriate. That would potentially help to stimulate investment if people reassess that and decided that the low interest rates that are currently set were easily overcome. I mean, that's many of the arguments, which is that we do have very low interest rates, and the yield curve suggests that they're expected to be low for quite some time, which means that there should be a lot more productive projects out there.
Okay, well, thank you, John, again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.